Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Justice Department and AT&T, President Obama and Jobs, you and your letters on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Carbonite Business, providing automatic online backup solutions for small businesses. Learn more and receive a free trial at Carbonite.com with code Marketplace.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday today, the very last day of August 2011. Good as always to have you with us. And with all due respect to those Sprint cell phone commercials, you probably can hear a pin drop at AT&T today. This morning, the Justice Department said ixnay to Ma Bell's takeover of T-Mobile. What would have been a $39 billion deal would have married up the second and fourth largest mobile companies in the country. The Obama administration says, though, that that would be bad for competition and for prices. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more now on the corporate story of the day.
The Justice Department says an AT&T T-Mobile union would mean higher prices and fewer choices for millions of customers. The deal would change the cell phone business dramatically, taking it from four major players to three, or more like two and a half, says telecom analyst Jeff Kagan.
It makes AT&T very, very strong. Verizon, very, very strong, and Sprint is out in the cold.
Kagan thinks Ma Bell will fight for T-Mobile. Not only would it have to pay T-Mobile at least $3 billion if the deal doesn't happen, AT&T desperately needs more access to the airwaves, known as Spectrum, to support all of the talking and web surfing its customers do.
You know, AT&T has had such Spectrum problems with all the reporting of all the iPhone and the wireless data traffic jams and all the complaints that people have had. That's why they're doing this deal.
Antitrust lawyer Mark Ostro says the Justice Department's case is strong, and it would be hard for AT&T to offer enough concessions to save the $39 billion deal.
By putting a stake in the ground and saying, here are the various problems we have with this transaction, it makes a settlement much more difficult.
So, what's next for T-Mobile? Deutsche Telekom wants to unload its U.S. division, and if the AT&T deal falls through, it will probably be looking for another buyer for T-Mobile. Carl Howe with the Yankee Group doesn't think that will be hard to find.
It's one of only four national networks in the United States, and even if they're the smallest of the players, they have national coverage, and they have fairly loyal customers.
Howe says Sprint might move to buy T-Mobile, as well as companies that want to expand into wireless communications like Comcast and Google. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Go ahead and pencil this one in on your calendars right now. Next Wednesday night, 8 o'clock Washington time, the president's going to clue us in on his plans to get people back to work and reducing the deficit. He's asked Congress for permission to address a joint session of Congress that evening. But I said pencil because House Speaker John Boehner said late this afternoon maybe another day would be better. Seems there's a big GOP presidential debate set for that night out here in California. But whatever the politics of it, the policy of it goes something like this. Simultaneously spending money to generate jobs in the short run while cutting spending and reforming the tax code over the long haul. On a more immediate note, immediate meaning today, the president called on Congress to pass a spending bill before it expires at the end of September to fund transportation because, the president said, and wait for it, there are jobs on the line. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has more now on job creation as Washington's job one.
President Obama said he wants to avoid another political impasse like the one last month that interrupted airport rebuilding projects and caused 74,000 temporary layoffs. Obama brought a small group of construction workers to a press conference in the Rose Garden.
If we don't extend this bill by the end of September, all of them will be out of a job just because of politics in Washington.
Leaders from the Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO were there, too, as if to show Congress there's broad support for the transportation bill. Both groups unveiled separate job creation recommendations today. Different plans, to be sure, but there was some overlap. It seems government stimulus is no longer a dirty word in Washington.
Perhaps the stimulus bill, the much maligned stimulus bill, actually might have had a little bit more impact than people had thought.
That's the Chamber of Commerce's chief economist, Martin Regalia. He says back in 2009, President Obama's $800 billion stimulus package helped the economy grow.
And then as the stimulus package waned and expired, you saw the economy drift down a little bit.
The chamber wants more government spending on infrastructure. The AFL-CIO does too, even with huge deficits, says President Richard Trumka.
The United States doesn't have a short-term debt crisis. It is a short-term jobs crisis.
Unions and the Chamber of Commerce are still divided over most policies, trade, taxes, and regulations among them. But for now, both want the government to be a sugar daddy for the economy once more. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Not that this is news, but jobs and the lack thereof are going to be the key issue in next year's presidential race. But you know what? For the millions of people who are unemployed, what they care about is how to find work now. Susan Poland was let go from her job a year ago. Today, she starts a new position. Susan, it's great to talk to you.
I'm thrilled to talk to you too, Kai.
Well, tell me about the new job.
It started today.
Wow.
And my boss took me to lunch, and we went to the French embassy. So I had to use my passport.
Oh, my. Well, my boss never takes me to lunch. it had a happy ending this period you were out of work, but it was a long year or so for you, right?
It was a very long year. I'm actually starting my job at the same employer exactly 1 year after my last day at the same place, but not in the same job and not in the same area.
Tell me about the year. What did you do to get by, and what was the mental strain like? I sort of can't imagine.
Well, we have a daughter that's in college, and she's in private college. And fortunately, I had some benefits, I had savings, and she had a scholarship, so I wasn't worried about that. However, I was finding myself getting up some nights and not sleeping.
Hmm.
Watching those Decora Eagles at 2 in the morning. But I was actually very sleepless and nervous the last few days starting a job. It was like new school.
Oh, that's interesting. Getting back into it.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was the process of finding this job like? I mean, you went back to the same employer, Georgetown University, as you left. So you had something of an advantage, I guess. But I imagine you sent out 1,000-plus resumes.
I never counted. I never counted. I am persistent and determined that I could work again and I could find work. And I did.
What's the difference between the old job you had and the new job?
I'm still doing research. It's about pharmaceutical companies and drug reps as mm-hmm. compared to the whole field of bioethics before.
I don't want to end this on a downer, but this job you have now, and we should say you've got a full-time job and you've also got a part-time job to help keep ends meet. But this full-time job you have is a term job, right? It's not a guaranteed forever employment.
It's technically a term job because that's all the money that this program has.
Mm-hmm.
My previous job was a term job also. It was 1 year offers, and every year it was renewed. So I had 13 years and 10 months of experience under those 1 year contracts. So I'm hoping that this will continue to be the same.
Yeah. But no guarantees, right?
There's no guarantees. There's no guarantees I found about anything.
Susan Poland in Washington, D.C., where she is now as of today. No longer among the unemployed in this country. Susan, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Wall Street couldn't get out of August fast enough. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I'm not sure this is necessarily a thing to celebrate, but once all said and done, Hurricane Irene's on track to be one of the 10 most expensive natural disasters this country's ever seen. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said today the tally in his state alone, parts of which have really been clobbered, could top $1 billion. Andy Revkin lives in Putnam County in the Hudson River Valley of New York, north of New York City. He also writes the .earth blog for the New York Times. Andy, good to have you with us.
It's good to be with you.
I guess the first thing to do is have you look out your window and tell us what you see out there still a week after the storm.
Well, I see a sad sight on our front lawn. We have a wonderful old walnut tree that has this now major crack through the heart of its trunk that I haven't bothered to call a tree guy because I'm sure they're way busier with stuff that's more important. But the roads here are truly a disaster. I live in a hilly area. You know, it's mostly hilly areas that have seen the worst outcomes from flooding, the Catskills, Vermont. It seems like any road that's named after either a stream or a bridge is in big trouble when these kinds of storms happen.
What are they telling you, though, Andy, about how long it's going to be before any of this stuff even starts to get fixed? I mean, with all the washouts and everything.
Well, the school buses are going to have to start rolling starting Friday, and they're not going to be able to roll in through a big chunk of this part of Putnam County. So that's the kind of thing that will start to really grate on people. And in my interviews and exchanges with people in the Catskills, it's far worse out there, where there are kind of people who are on islands, essentially cut off from the grid of roadways.
Daily economic life is semi-normal. I mean, can you get to town and get groceries and fresh milk and all that?
Yeah, that's not a problem. And we have neighbors who lost power for a lot longer than we did, including some who still don't have power. There's more and more neighbors of ours who've chosen to invest in a generator. You know, it takes one or two or three storms and you start to say, you know, we're always running cost benefit analyses in our heads, and any consumer, any citizen is. And for me, it's been on things like I finally got gutters. I was chastened late last winter. We had a kind of a heavy rainstorm on top of snow and had the third flooding episode in our basement. And that was the one that put me over the limit of saying, you know, we really need gutters. And it made a huge difference.
The gutters thing is an interesting analogy for infrastructure investment, right? I mean, you put on gutters and states build new bridges and highways.
Yeah, and looking at the Gilboa Dam for the city, this is the dam holding back that Schoharie Reservoir.
Yeah.
And 5 years ago, they realized it's a 92-year-old dam with major structural problems, holding back more than 17 billion gallons of water with thousands of people living downstream. And they did some initial repairs a couple of years ago, and they're poised to do a $350 million essentially reconstruction of the dam. I'm sure there are city planners who realize they just dodged a really big bullet there and would probably have preferred that that dam have been reconstructed by the time the storm hit. But at least now they'll be girded better for the next one.
Andy Revkin writes the Dot Earth blog for The New York Times. He Skyped with us from his home in Putnam County, New York. Andy, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
For a weekend, Hurricane Irene transfixed media attention.
Commentator David Frum.
National networks, as well as local news, they reported breathlessly, minute by minute, the progress of the storm. And you know what? While some of the reporting was silly, the shows, by and large, did a public service. People took precautions. The barrage of warnings had a positive effect. But why is it only weather stories that command such breathless attention? Meanwhile, the world's largest currency union, the euro, continues to careen toward disaster. The euro's travails weigh heavily on the United States economy, too. Yet just try getting anybody interested in that outside specialized financial media. Day by day, week by week, the fiscal and monetary authorities in Europe are making decisions, mostly very bad decisions, that are hastening the day when a southern European country either quits the euro or is ejected. That would be followed by debt defaults and bank failures. Bank failures that may well contaminate non-European banks as well. It's not a sure thing. But then, neither was the flooding of Lower Manhattan by Irene a sure thing. We still worried. We still took precautions. And when we got lucky, we were glad to have paid attention. Yet where is the minute-by-minute coverage of our financial exposure? If the worst happens, it will happen for most Americans out of a wild blue yonder, just as the crash of the housing bubble did. The things that most acutely threaten our lives and prosperity, especially financial and economic events, do not always suit the formulas of rapid-fire news delivery. They become dramatic only after it is too late.
Once upon a time, David Frum was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Today, he's the editor of Frum Forum. Coming up next week, Robert Reich, your views, pretty much whatever works for you. Send them to us online, marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. Coming up, for green technology startups, the Pentagon seal of approval can mean lots of the other green.
In the minds of an investor, that's an incredibly trustworthy endorsement.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, Back in Black really ought to be the song today. The Dow Industrials edged into positive territory for the year. It rose 53 points, 0.4%, closed at 11,613. The NASDAQ inched up 3 points, 0.1%, 2,579. The S&P 500 added 5 points, about 0.5%, ended things at 1,218. For the month, which does, you have to say, provide about a year's worth of excitement, the Dow fell 4.4%. The NASDAQ shed 6.4%. The S&P 500 gave back 5 7/10 of 1%. We told you about the Obama administration's move to squash AT&T's purchase of T-Mobile. That hurt both companies. AT&T shares dialed down 3.8%. T-Mobile's parent Deutsche Telekom saw its U.S. shares sink 7.3%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.23%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Business, online automatic backup designed for small businesses. Carbonite Business automatically backs up files to a secure offsite location. In the event of a hard drive crash, virus, or other problem, files can easily be recovered. More information and a free trial by visiting Carbonite.com using the code Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve Board holds a forum titled The Housing Market Going Forward, Lessons Learned from the Recent Crisis. The Commerce Department reports on construction spending for July. And the House Ways and Means Subcommittee on Social Security holds a field hearing in Plano, Texas on Social Security numbers and child identity theft. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. This was quite a day to be in the oil business. In Moscow, BP's offices there were raided by Russian special forces, assault rifles, black uniforms, the whole deal. Not, though, as it happens, all that unusual in the freewheeling Russian business climate. And it's something to keep an eye on, especially if you're another petroleum conglomerate by the name of ExxonMobil, which just yesterday struck a $1 billion deal to look for oil in the Russian Arctic. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill reports.
Russia hasn't been a super easy place to do business, to put it mildly.
Russia is a country where companies that operated there in the 90s and into the 2000s had safe houses that they used for their executives in case there was a problem.
Amy Myers Jaffe is a research fellow at the Baker Institute at Rice University. She says back in the 90s, energy companies wanted to work with Russia. It didn't go well.
We had companies that wound up in lawsuits. We have companies that got frustrated and withdrew.
So the Exxon deal is undeniably risky.
Might this turn out the same way as every other attempt people have made in Russia, where it looked very promising in the beginning and it's, you know, sort of hard to bring that to an outstanding conclusion?
Jaffe thinks it's a risk that Exxon can safely take. Edward Chow is a fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
I think Exxon has to go where it perceives the opportunities are.
He says finding new oil supplies may require oil companies to get in close with some less than ideal bedfellows.
But you know, oil companies have to go to where the resources are and hope that they can manage the conditions under which they are forced by governments to operate under.
Chow says the $3+ billion investment is one that Exxon can afford to make, especially because the promise of the Arctic payout is so big. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
There was a lot of talk about our story on college professors last week and how the University of Texas is coming up with a system to track faculty productivity. Karen Gunther from Crawfordsville, Indiana, says a quantitative approach to learning like that, it just doesn't work.
Lots of studies have shown that students learn better in small classes. They can't slip through the cracks. They get more attention from the professors. They do more writing and thus improve on their writing. Yes, larger class sizes might allow us to crank through more students, but at what cost?
Christopher Bird from Dallas, Texas, wrote about the bigger picture.
There's a lot of bureaucracy and there's a lot of overhead associated with the universities. And so simply measuring the productivity of the professors is looking at only one piece of it.
As you'll hear in about 90 seconds or so, our series on the military and energy use wraps up today. Before that, though, Lee Kasner from Tampa, Florida, wanted to add a historical note about the United States cutting off its shipments of oil to Japan in the lead up to World War II.
This was one of the first times an oil embargo was used as a weapon in peacetime. It became such a potent weapon in the 1970s that there was a great fear it would be used against us by the Soviets. The Carter Doctrine was developed to make clear that interfering with the oil supplies of the United States was practically equivalent to a declaration of war.
Last word this week goes to the grammarians and our use of the phrase completely decimated in a story Monday talking about the effects of Hurricane Irene on businesses in Vermont. Joe Kesselman from Arlington, Massachusetts, was one of several to correct us. Decimated, Mr. Kesselman wrote, means literally to reduce by one-tenth. By definition, there is no such thing as completely decimated. So send us your history lessons, your dictionary entries, whatever you like. Go to marketplace.org, click on that link that says contact. All right, time now for your Marketplace Random Technology Quiz. It's kind of an easy one, actually. What do GPS, the internet, and radar all have in common? Yes, they are indeed all innovations that were first developed by the American military. The next wave? A lot of people are betting on green technologies, that the Pentagon can take them from laboratory to battlefield and then onto large scale, that is, money-making commercial use. So from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong has the final installment of his series on the military and energy.
So you've got your protective cover here.
Entrepreneur Zach Lyman in D.C. has a hybrid gizmo, a generator that makes electricity from solar or wind or fuel. His big breakthrough? Getting a seal of approval. No, not good housekeeping. Try the Marines.
In almost every setting, it gives us bragging rights.
As in, my renewable toy went to Afghanistan, and now the Army is buying a bunch more.
People who are skeptical, you know, yeah, that's kind of a niche technology. It's not a niche technology anymore. Look at the Marines start to use it. In the minds of an investor, that's an incredibly trustworthy endorsement.
The military is trying out a host of technologies to cut its fossil fuel use and to limit fuel convoy casualties. And along the way, it's pulling green energy from lab to civilian market. Today, the Pentagon spends about $2 billion a year on clean tech, but that could get to $26 billion by 2030. Take new fuels. Navy Secretary Ray Mabus plans a green strike group powered entirely by nuclear and biofuels.
By 2020, we'll have a market of 8 million barrels of alternative fuels. It's a pretty substantial market. As you begin to scale that up, price almost automatically comes down.
A scaling up is when lots of startups run out of investor money. They call it the financial valley of death. But some companies can proclaim, I will fear no evil, for the Pentagon aren't with me. Biofuels maker Solazyme sold the DOD 20,000 gallons of fuel made from algae. The first batch sold for $424 a gallon, and that helped it afford facilities to go commercial. Co-founder Harrison Dillon.
It's one thing to do something at small scale in a laboratory, even repeatably in a laboratory. We've been doing this in a commercial scale fermentation facility continuously for over a year.
His company, by the way, has one of those fairy tale beginnings.
In 2003, Jonathan Wolfson and I started Solazyme in a Palo Alto garage.
This year it went public. And wherever it goes from here, the point is that military funding can give high-risk ideas a chance. Consultant Suzanne Hunt is with the Carbon War Room.
Someone has to pay for those expensive test batches. It's very similar to what the military did with cell phones and computer chips. They were the ones that bought the big, clunky, super expensive, you know, first model.
And they may play a big cultural role in the new energy economy. Hunt says that just as the military was an early institution to desegregate, soldiers, sailors, Marines, and airmen are now early adopters of renewables.
They bring that knowledge and that experience back to their communities. And they tend not to be the same communities as one often thinks of, you know, Silicon Valley, Manhattan, whatever people think of with clean tech.
As for alternative fuels, the military has a lot riding on it. The Air Force, the Navy, the Marines, they all hope to cut their fossil fuel use in half. But is the technology ready? Is now the right time to bet on it?
We're pretty far from understanding at all whether algae will ever be a commercially viable fuel.
That's energy analyst Jim Bardis at the RAND Corporation think tank. He wrote a recent paper that drew big-time controversy. It wonders if leading biofuels contenders can actually produce cheaply and at scale anytime soon.
There's a bit of naivete in parts of the community with regard to the challenge of getting these advanced energy systems going. I mean, for at least 30 years, photovoltaic technology was 5 years away.
That is the nature of innovation. Lots of cool ideas fail. But that doesn't stop the Pentagon from spreading out its bets on things like hybrid electric warships, solar panel tents and power chargers, rechargeable radio batteries, LED lights. And each time the military holds a conference to talk about it, the entrepreneurs come, smelling opportunity. Contractor and retired Colonel Dan Nolan says these are not your typical manly defense contractors. They're energy geeks.
These are kinder and gentler. You get people that are a little more thoughtful. That is a difference that you see here that you don't see at your normal warhead conference.
These are startups crossing the innovation valley of death and looking to the Pentagon as their shepherd. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The other stories in our series and some web extras as well are on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, which hits home with yours truly after a particularly gruesome boarding experience yesterday at Kennedy Airport coming home from New York. A guy by the name of Jason Steffen has apparently also had the same displeasure. He decided to do something about it. Catch is, he's an astrophysicist, not a radio guy, so his plan actually works. Forget boarding by rows or inside, outside, or front to back, or whatever you want. The way to do it, Steffen says, is alternating rows. Gives people time and space to stuff their bags in the overhead without jamming up the aisles. There is, of course, more to it. And there's a video, courtesy of our friends at WBEZ. You can check the link on our website. It's marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media, on this Wednesday. Today, the Dow rose 53 points, about 0.5%. The NASDAQ inched up 3 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 added 5 points, about 0.5% there. Bahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time, back here, climate change and capital improvements.
If you look at this real estate, this is the highest per square foot valued real estate in the United States. These are small lots with very valuable homes on them, so not having a solution is not an option.
I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, that's American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.